extend my appreciation to the people of High Country Baptist Church.
The welcome that you've extended to us in this conference, we know that this can be kind of a hardship for you, and practically speaking, it's time out of your week, especially when it's beautiful outside like this. There are probably 100 things that you'd rather be doing. I live in Wisconsin, and every time I take a look outside and I see mountains, my heart is in the highlands, but I've got a thing to present here. So so bear with me. Just a little bit of background about me. As Jason hinted, my path to conservatism was a little bit more circuitous maybe than some. I was actually born in an unbelieving home, more or less, or extremely nominal belief. I was actually saved in the charismatic movement. And by charismatic, I'm not talking about, you know, Reformed charismatic where they still believe stuff. I'm talking about Word of Faith, Benny Hinn style, charismaticism. I was in that particular church setting for about 4 years. The first 2 years, I loved it. The last 2 years, I didn't know where else to go, because everybody else, as I'd been taught, was backslidden, right? When we went to softball tournaments, so there's Olivet Lukewarm instead of Lutheran, and so forth. We had our, the backslid Baptists. So, I had no idea where to go. So, I left there and I went to the Evangelical Free Church, where everybody else who went out the back door of that charismatic church, footnote, lots of them, where they all ended up. And then, after about 2 years, I realized that they didn't believe anything. At least the charismatics believed wacky stuff, right? But the Evangelical Free Church, they had kind of a don't ask, don't tell policy on just about everything. So that's really not satisfying if your heart's inclination, even if you don't know how to express it, right? If your heart's inclination is, I want to love this God who saved me. I owe him glory. How do I give him glory? And one place says, book around the auditorium with a tambourine and a flag, right? Decently in an order. Well, whatever that means. And the other place says, do whatever you want, essentially, within, some boundaries. Like, don't commit adultery, and that's about it. So my journey to conservatism, and then I ended up at Central Seminary. Kevin Bowder, thank you for everything that you've done for me. And that's the story, right? Well, it's really not, because in that journey, I played bass guitar in the Campus Crusade band, right? I would go to, even when I was becoming Baptist, I'd go to the Baptist church some Sundays. Other Sundays, I would farm myself out to churches with praise bands to play in their praise bands, right? And, it took a long time to really start to see that what was being promised or what was theoretically going on was this burning bush experience, and what was actually being delivered was a lot more like golden calves, if that makes sense, right? And so my journey out has been good riddance, brush the dust off, things like that, leave that far behind. But what I've come to realize is that for a lot of people, that's their place. Those are their people. That's their place. And some of them, in various manifestations, are in my church, right? Oh, they don't want to go do the praise band stuff, booking around with flags and tambourines, standing on the chairs, barking like that. They don't want to do stuff like that. But they're doing an earlier version of that. I look at it this way. Some people still want to use their 386 and try to get Windows 95 to run on it, right? And that's the inclination behind these churches who camp out on Fanny Crosby and sing 40 of her 9,000 songs, right? That's the inclination there. Other people want to use a computer like mine, which is nice and robust, and in fact, it's so far advanced that it doesn't even work with the equipment here. Otherwise, I'd have this fancy modernist PowerPoint presentation for you. So, and that's essentially what it is. It's taking Charles Finney's new measures and applying various degrees of updates to it. And then feeling the freedom to get off where you're not comfortable anymore. Whether it's nostalgia or sentimentality, or if you can find some sort of, find something in the fern seed of the penumbra of Scripture to justify this. But really what it boils down to, I think, here's what it boils down to. For us as conservatives, what we are concerned to do is conserve things. Now, write that down. That's going to be on the quiz, right? But we are concerned to conserve things. What are we concerned to conserve? And that's a big question, isn't it? And we find answers in places like Jude, right? Jude verse 3, where he says we want to conserve things like the faith once delivered, the faith, right? When you see the words "the faith," you're thinking about that system of belief that the apostles formulated that we have to try to hand down to subsequent generations. We try to hand that down without spoiling, without messing it up too bad. In some places, we receive it, and there's a patina of the tradition received from our fathers, as the story goes. And we're trying to clean that off in some places. Get more clarity. Try to reach back further. But what about everything else? What about the institutions that have arisen over the generations around this body of doctrine, right? To try to safeguard it, to try to inculcate it into subsequent generations. What about those institutions? I'm being intentionally a little bit vague here. Because those institutions, that's everything from the shape of our architecture to the songs in our hymnals to the way that we dress when Scott says, dress casual, and Kevin Bowder shows up in his casual suit, right? There are implications for these. He's my professor. I can do that. I'm graduated now. I'm an alumnus. I write checks to that institution. But these are the kinds of things that we need to consider. Because I'm looking here, and towards the back, there are a bunch of kids here who need to get this stuff. They need to get it from us. They need to get it through us. And gentlemen, even we who have been on this conservative journey for a while, and, I've got a lot further to go than a lot of you because, well, I'm not a PhD, and my dad was a bike mechanic, okay? So there's a lot of stuff that is just remedial training for me. But how are we going to pass down something that we don't necessarily even have an entire grasp on? Well, I can tell you one way we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it by just haphazardly borrowing forms that we don't understand. We're not going to accomplish that by just saying, here, kids, do this. And you'll be fine. After all, look at us. Well, we can't say that, right? Because there's something that we want to recover that we haven't fully recovered yet. And they're going to need to carry on the work. And so I'd like to start with a definition. It's a definition by a gentleman named Edmund Burke. You've probably heard this before. Maybe you have. He's defining society. And I think it's a very good definition for us. Society is a contract between the past, the present, and those yet unborn. The past, the present, those yet unborn. We owe a debt of loyalty to men like St. Augustine. I call him St. Augustine, not St. Augustine. All deference to our brother who pronounces lots of things wrong. But but he does it in full earnestness, and that's what's good. But no, honestly, I feel like I'm just regurgitating a lot of stuff that's come before us over these past 2 days. But we owe a debt of gratitude, not just for the faith once delivered, but for the institutions that were designed to safeguard and promulgate that faith. Right? Because there are things that were tested in the crucibles of first century persecution. There were things that were codified in the New Testament that the very earliest church had to figure out in their milieu how to embody that. And they found some remarkably good ways. And so I'm not trying to say that we imbibe this stuff and just do it uncritically. But I'm saying that we're fools if we're not even considering the past, which is exactly what our brother who talked about, you know, people who just want to have a relationship with Jesus. There's a lack of consideration for the past there. But there's also, I would argue, a real lack of consideration for those who are yet unborn. When I got to Grace Baptist Church in Boyceville, Wisconsin, one of my long-standing running jokes there, and you can probably tell from me that I have a lot of long-standing running jokes. My material gets probably old and grating on people over time. But one of my long-standing jokes is talking about our 100-year plan. Why is it a joke? Because a lot of our congregation is over 80. They're not going to be around. I'm over 40, okay? Am I going to be around to see the fruition of our 100-year plan? No, and that's the point. That's the point. The people who stacked up that pile of rocks in the middle of the river, you know the Bible story I'm talking about? They weren't doing it for themselves. What did God tell them? He said, the point was, is when your sons and daughters look at that pile of rocks there in the river, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to tell them the story. So that means that mom and dad have to remember the story. And they have to pass it down. And they have to make sure that they're taking their kids by the pile of rocks, right? So that the kids can hear how God got them across the river. How God did this wonderful thing. The pile of rocks needed to be there. If it tips over, you stack it back up. Okay, so society is a contract between the past, the present, and those yet unborn. Now, there's a word in my title that I need to define. Improvidence. Okay, so this is something that parents, you can castigate your children and say, stop being improvident, right? When they do this, or when they manifest this characteristic. It's lack of care in the management of resources, not foreseeing and providing for the future. Okay, so that's improvidence. A really good example comes from Robert Louis Stevenson's book, Treasure Island. Okay, improvidence is a characteristic of the pirates, right? So when the pirates got the ship towards the end of the book, what did they do? Well, they cooked all the food in the ship at once. And then when they were done pigging out and drinking themselves into a relative stupor, what did they do? They threw the rest of the cooked food into the fire. Right? They took the store of firewood and built a fire so big. I mean, they're in the tropics, for heaven's sake. They built the fire so big that they couldn't even get close to it. That's an object of improvidence. Proverbs 12:27, whoever is slothful will not roast his game. Right? You take something in hunting, and you leave it hang in the garage for a couple days. You come out, and it's green and smelly. You can't eat it anymore. So now you got to go hunting again. That's improvidence. Two other terms. Those of you who have studied linguistics, you're familiar with these terms. Others of you may not be. Okay, so one word is synchronic. Synchronic. Have you ever synchronized your swimming or your timepieces or something like that? You're bringing things to the same time. Well, synchronic in linguistics and the way I'm going to borrow it is means that it's concerned with events existing in a limited time period and ignoring historical antecedents. Okay, so synchronic basically means the church of what's happening now. Some of you may or may not be familiar with that, Flip Wilson. Okay, good, you're not familiar with that. That means you're more sanctified than I am. Concerned with events happening in a limited time period, ignoring historical antecedents. Contrast this with the word diachronic, which means of, relating to, or dealing with phenomena, as of language or culture, as they occur or change over a period of time. Okay, so realizing that we're not just the church of what's happening now, that maybe the people who, well, not in this church, but in our church is 80 years old, 81 years old now, right? All of the people who constituted the church are dead. Do their opinions about what Grace Baptist Church is supposed to be still matter? The answer is yes, because their names are still on the documents. They have a seat at our table. When we're discussing things pertaining to Grace Baptist Church of Boyceville, Wisconsin, we know things have changed. We understand that. We understand all that. But guess who was also there at the table? The charter members of the church embodied in that church a system of values that we don't reject. We don't just cast that off. And so Synchronic would be concerned just with things going on now, right? And I've got this idea of a cruciform way of looking at it, right? Synchronic is the arms going out, okay? So it's my relationship with Christ and my desire to relate to other people, whether that's evangelistically or whether that's in fellowship. But it's all related to what's happening now, okay? Well, we need to add a component to that. We need to add roots to that tree, as it were, okay? We have to go back to Grandpa Smith, who cut down the trees to build the original log cabin church, and so forth. That it was his hard work. It was their investment. It was their resources over time that they were able to buy their original building. We honor that. We honor the past. But we also are thinking upwardly in terms of our 100-year plan. Down the road, what's going on? What are we doing now to make sure that the faith once delivered makes it to them unspoiled, right? And what are we doing now to make sure that we're passing on institutions that are going to help them to serve the Lord with reverence and awe because He is a consuming fire? What are we doing? So synchronic versus diachronic. Two words that are helpful to understand. Now, there are a couple of Bible passages that I'm more or less, for the sake of time, I am going to whet your interest because that's essentially my level of understanding right now. This, folks, this is new thinking to me. I find it compelling thinking, but I'm not a scholar. I'm not a researcher per se. I'm just a guy with some concerns for his own local church, other local churches, and I find that when I discuss these things with other pastors, that they share these concerns. But there are a few places in your Bible, such as Matthew chapter 22, verse 32, says, "But regarding the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was spoken to you by God? I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob." Here's what Jesus says about that. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. Okay, and now we understand that living there is in a technical sense. They're not walking among us. That would be weird, right? But they are in a sense, they're not gone. They're not gone. And I tie that thematically with Hebrews 12:1, which our brother preached he alluded to last night. It says, "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses," pause, who are those witnesses? And you look up in the context, and the people in chapter 11. They are, in a sense, bearing witness to somebody, and or something. Well, somebody too, but they are surrounding us. And I think that we do well to extend, after a manner, the boundaries of Hebrews chapter 11. To include those faithful people who have gone before us, who've left us things that we're supposed to preserve. We're surrounded with that great cloud of witnesses. And here the inference is, let us lay aside every encumbrance, the sin which so easily entangles us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Okay? Now, but the idea that there are these people in our past, and their opinion matters. This is an old way of thinking. The other side of it, is found in Deuteronomy chapter 4. Well, all through Deuteronomy, really. He says, only give heed to yourself, keep your soul diligently so that you do not forget the things which your eyes have seen, and they do not depart from your heart all the days of your life. Now, I'm going to pause there. It's kind of right in the middle of Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 9. The things that the people in Deuteronomy saw, do we get to see those things in the same sense that they did? Okay, kids, who here has seen the Exodus? Any of you? I saw the movie. That doesn't count. No, but the point is, we don't get to see those things. We don't get to see the cloudy pillar and stuff. How do we know about it? How were their children going to know? That because their children didn't have the Old Testament. What did they have? They had parents. Right? And that's why it says, but make them known to your sons and your grandsons. Pass it down. Get it right. And then later in that chapter, it says, when you become the father of children and children's children and have remained long in the land and act corruptly and make an idol in the form of anything and do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord your God so as to provoke him to anger and so forth. Right? But how are they supposed to think? They're supposed to think in terms of when you become the father of children and children's children and have remained long in the land. That's important. Because what happens when you sit somewhere in the same place? Exactly what happens to us when our blood sugar droops because it's time for lunch. We get distracted, right? I'm looking at some of you. No, just kidding. But that's the point, right? We don't get to see the cloud of fire. We don't get to see, you know, oh, to see the dawn of the darkest day. Well, we don't get to see that. We don't get to see that. And that's the point. That's why we need institutions. That's why we need things like hymns. To traduce that, to preserve it, to pass it on. And we need more than that. We need good literature. We need good systematic theology, right? Because systematic theology does more than just help us to understand the Bible. Systematic theology looks both in the book and looks out at the world and tries to bring it all together and tries to make a coherent whole out of it. And systematic theologians who try to start over from the very beginning do us a great disservice in not borrowing that which is good from the past and building on it. So when you become the father of children and children's children have remained long in the land. Think about that. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father. He will show you. Your elders and they will tell you. Again, that's in the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is a treasure trove for you know getting this in your mind and in your heart. And then in Deuteronomy chapter 12, there's a rather stern warning throughout the chapter against idolatry that would come to pass, and God knew it, and Moses knew it, and the people were informed of that. But the question they were not to ask is found in verse 30. Verse 30 says, how did these nations serve their gods that I also may do the same? Okay, so what's being asked there? So I see that these nations have these groves, the trees, and they have the pretty high places. You guys have some pretty high places here too. Why don't we incorporate those in our worship? Right? But what does God say? How do these nations serve their gods that I also may do the same? And verse 31, I'm using the ESV here, and the ESV is a very interpretive translation. But it says, you shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. You shall not worship, he doesn't say idols, he says, you shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. Or NASB says that you shall not deal with the Lord your God in that way. Don't treat God like that. And why? Because in that way, here's what the nations have done. Every abominable thing that the Lord hates, they have done for their gods. And they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Right? So what do they do with those ways? Should we use those ways? No, because those ways have associations. Those ways were designed to inculcate a different set of values. You build a golden calf to represent your values. Does that make sense? All that an idol is an embodiment of a set of values. This is what is important to me. This is what makes sense to me. This is how I understand the world, and this is what I understand to be at the back of everything. It's an embodiment of values. And so when you say, how did these nations serve their gods, that I also may do the same, what Moses tells them and what God tells them, you shall not worship the Lord your God that way. You shall not embody your values like that, because those aren't your values. That's Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 30 and 31, if you're curious. And so where did all of this end up? Well, by the time you get to 2 Kings chapter 17, here's what's going on. This is at the end of the journey. So Deuteronomy, beginning, 2 Kings, end. They served idols. Well, they weren't supposed to do that, were they? Concerning which the Lord had said to them, you shall not do this thing. Okay, so now he's just reminding them of something that should have been passed down all along. And they'd had prophets and everything else, judgments against them. They'd had good kings to tell them that they're not supposed to do that. They should have known this all along. And it says, they feared the Lord and served their own gods according to the custom of the nations from among whom they had been carried away into exile. Now, this is talking about this batch of Assyrians and whatnot that had just been kind of dumped into Samaria. They had the lions come and attack. You guys familiar with the story, 2 Kings 17? The lions came and they were wondering why the lions were trying to kill them and stuff like that. Oh, you're not honoring the God of the land. So they sent a Levite priest down there and he instructed them how to worship Yahweh, right? And so they learned how to worship Yahweh. And what did they do? They mixed it in with everything else. It's what they knew to do. Sound familiar? So that's an old way of failing. To this day, they do according to the earlier customs. They do not fear the Lord, nor do they follow their statutes or their ordinances or the law or the commandments, which the Lord commanded the sons of Jacob, whom he named Israel. They learned the ways of the Lord. They mixed it with everything else. And what went away? The ways of the Lord. So those are some biblical examples. I think that as we look at some of these contemporary examples of synchronic versus diachronic, we'll start to see some real similarities just in the trajectory of the Old Testament, the failure of God's people as they left off the ancient stuff that they were supposed to remember. What happened? What replaced it? And we'll start to see that just in the modern evangelical movement. Now listen to this quote. The author says this. He says, the new, and he's talking about music specifically here, the new is needed to express the contemporaneity of the gospel. Okay? The here and now-ness. Okay, so how do you tell people that Jesus is here and now? Well, you can't tell them in old-fashioned ways because they'll associate that with old-fashionedness. How do you tell them that Jesus is here now? Are we supposed to tell them that Jesus is the God of what's happening now? That's the question, I think. But you need to use new ways to express that. It says the fact that Christ lives today and that his purposes find meaning only in the reality of today's world. You catch that? You catch what's going on there? The fact that Christ lives today and that his purposes find meaning only in the reality of today's world? What does that sound like? Sounds like theological liberalism, isn't it? Now, if that's the flag that went up, congratulations, your sensors are working. He goes on and says, moreover, it is only the new that can communicate with the society in which we live, that society which has not already responded to the God of the living church. Only the new can tell these people in their own language that God knows them and loves them and invites them into a relationship with himself and his people. Only the new can do that. So clearly, this is a guy who is bought into this synchronic idea, right? In fact, what he's doing is he's deliberately cutting off everything from his xiphoid process down, right? The base of his ribcage down is just gone. No, we need the new. And if we can take old stuff and make it sound new, that's okay. But what we really need is, well, in his day, songs about sending satellites into space and landing on the moon, right? And this is a little after, but discovering penicillin, right? And cathode ray tubes, which we don't even use anymore. And the miracle of NPR, right? And things like that. So that's Robert Mitchell. His book is Ministry and Music. Now, here's another manifestation of that. He says, this is actually a different author. And this author says, not only do you accept as significant and good the music that was meaningful to you in your teenage years, right? But you also tend to make that music a part of your culture and even a part of your worship. By the time you're 50, the style of music that was popular when you were 20 becomes to be incorporated into your hymnals. Now, this was written in 1971. So 20 years prior to this, what was on the radio? Okay. Now, some of you are saying, 1971, does that year even exist? I wasn't there. Okay. Yeah, right. I wasn't either. But I think that the principle holds true, and we don't even use hymnal. We're such throwbacks. We're writing a hymnal, right? That's counterculture, folks. Because a hymnal is a concrete embodiment of values. That's counterculture these days. But what he's saying here is that the music they were rocking out to in the 50s, well, that's in the church now, right? That's in the evangelical church. And all the rock operas and things like that. Thankfully, not much of this stuff has made it to today. But that was his observation. That was his, in Eternity Magazine, April of 1971. And so what they're saying is that, you know, basically what we do, and this is kind of the default position, is we update revivalism for ourselves. You know, we take the popular music that we grew up with, and then when we get old and get religion, we're going to bring that into the church with us because that's what we're familiar with. That embodies our values. That's very important. Just like the Canaanites wanted to bring that in with them, just like the Assyrians wanted to bring that in with them. That's exactly what a lot of people want to do, that exact same thing with the church. Now, How was that defended even back then? Well, a guy named Jimmy Owens, and that name doesn't mean a thing to me. Some of you who are more plugged in than I am might know who Jimmy Owens. Anybody here know what a Jimmy Owens is? All right, we got a couple of you. Okay, both of you have gray hair, so I don't feel bad. Good. The crown of wisdom has allowed you to say who Jimmy Owens is. But Jimmy Owens says flatly, and I'm quoting here, soul winning is the only aim. The music is, well, it's enjoyable for sure, but our real aim is soul winning. Okay? Soul winning. That's what they were defending it with. And that comes from another, a different article in the April 1971 version or edition of Eternity Magazine. So you can see what they were trying to defend and propagate there. Now, let's bring this forward to today. Those are early arguments for bringing rock forms into the church. Well, it's just what we were listening to in the 50s. Why not bring it into church? It embodies our values. And it's handy-dandy for evangelism. But let's fast forward a few years, and some of you are going to recognize this quote. It is my deep conviction that anybody can be one to Christ. Anybody tracking with me so far? If you discover the felt needs to his or her heart. That key to each person's heart is unique, so it is sometimes difficult to discover. It may take some time to identify it. But the most likely place to start is with the person's felt needs. Who knows where that quote comes from? Oh, okay, amen. Okay, that's Rick Warren in the Purpose-Driven Church. That's page 219. A little while later, page 285, he says this. For the first time in history, there exists a universal music style that can be heard in every country of the world. It's called contemporary pop slash rock. This is the primary musical style we've chosen to use at Saddleback. After surveying those who we were reaching, we made the strategic decision to stop singing hymns in our secret services. Within a year of deciding what would be our sound, Saddleback exploded with growth. Are you connecting the dots here? Before, he's saying, if we can figure out people's felt needs, like Pelagius and Finney and those guys were trying to do, if we can figure out people's felt needs, we can reach anybody for Christ. And what apparently were people's felt needs? Pop, rock, contemporary music. Because he says it right here. That's when the church went boom. And, you know, without so much as admitting it, on pages 219, 285, there's a couple pages in there of intervening material, but really, let's connect the dots here. What really caused Saddleback to grow? Well, he says, within a few years of that, deciding what their sound, Saddleback exploded with growth. That was evidently the felt need that really drove that. Now, he used the term seeker services, right? And I want to be careful here. The early architects of Willow Creek, I really want to be careful to be charitable and fair. The early architects of the Willow Creek project wanted to make a hard and fast distinction between seeker services. Those were over here, right? If there was a drum set and stuff over here, that's a seeker service. That is designed for people who are Christianity curious, who just have some intellectual objections that need to be answered, and they will be full-blooded church members. They distinguished that from real worship, and they said, "Ne'er the twain shall meet." That's the early architects of the Willow Creek movement, okay? Now, I'm saying that to be charitable. Now, and the reason I have to keep saying that I'm saying that to be charitable is because I don't feel charitable about it. I went to a church, the Evangelical Free Church I went to. They had just gotten their copies of the Purpose-Driven Church. And they burned the organ with fire. Ties went through the shredder. Bibles disappeared from the racks and from the pulpit. The pulpit itself disappeared for a while, but then he needed a place to put his props, right? Because when you're preaching about the log and the sawdust, you need to have somewhere to set that stuff. So the pulpit came back. But everything became provisional. Everything became provisional. Everything became contingent on how it works. And you know what? You know what happened? The serious people's services dwindled down to nothing because all the good stuff was in the seeker services. That's where you're going to get the movie clips. That's where you're going to get 5 minutes of Schindler's List. Right? Did anybody here ever see that particular sermon? The Schindler's List one? Nobody here was an evangelical. Okay, that's me. Churches all over the United States and Canada and the UK preached the exact same sermon with a five-minute clip about, you know, at the end of Schindler's List where he's weeping and saying, this gold pin I've got, I could have saved more people with this. Well, why aren't you doing that for Jesus? That was the point of the sermon, right? And everybody preached the same one. I don't know if some of you heard it. I even found it in one of our preaching books for seminary, that exact sermon. Talk about a deja vu moment. But here's what a very sympathetic critic of the Willow Creek model says about that idea. You've got the seeker service over here, You've got the serious people service over here, and the idea was to get these people to move from here over to here. So you've got, you know, a seeker church, then you've got grown-up church, essentially. And he says, what is distinctive about a Willow Creek seeker event? Essentially, it is pre-evangelistic entertainment. Okay, pre-evangelistic entertainment, getting people ready. A highly captivating 60-minute infomercial for Christianity. Charles Finney be proud? And then she says, thousands of curious seekers are drawn to the Willow Creek campus each week, intrigued by a church that is not only radically fluent in their language and music, but also in the issues they face day to day. You see that? That's the seeker service, right? It's supposed to be fluent in the culture. It's supposed to embody their values as a way of attracting people. But what is the result? It says, and she goes on to say, it is all too easy for believers to use seeker services in place of worship and to justify themselves by saying, I've been to church. Moreover, new believers are inclined to hothouse or use it as a greenhouse, essentially, in the non-worship setting where they were planted. And so here we are, a couple generations later. And what do we have? We have exactly this. We have exactly this result. Now, I'm drawing nigh on my time, but Jason's introduction was extremely thorough. And so I'm just going to take a minute here to talk about one more thing. He says, one more quote, as one leader of a seeker-driven church admits, unfortunately, whatever your introductory orientation is in a church, that becomes your point of reference. Believers who come to Christ through a seeker event have a tendency to make that home. That becomes home. And you may wonder, why are you conservatives so fired up against youth ministry? It's because exactly what this seeker-driven church leader says. The Christianity that you're one to is the Christianity that wins your heart. And you know, if that is seeker driven, whether it's through you know, puppet shows and candy and stuff like that, or whether it's rock bands and, you know, dramas and things like that, that's what you're one to, that's your home now. That's your home now. Unless you go through an excruciating journey like I had to go through. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. Going out of church and sitting in my car and weeping so violently that I couldn't drive home at the way the name of the Lord Jesus Christ was blasphemed and instrumentalized and commodified. But here's the point. And ultimately, here's the bottom line. Somebody needs to minister to these people. We're going to be coming out of these churches, and it's one of the things that's kind of baked in. Hey, I used the metaphor. It's one of the things that's baked into the seeker-sensitive, seeker-driven model that just about everybody is using now. Why do I say that? Well, because everybody's expectations are that church is going to be kind of entertaining. And there are going to be people, the back door is very big in these churches. They're going to be saying, there's got to be something more than this. Well, they're going to come into churches like ours, our conservative churches. And we have to be able to answer their questions. Well, why can't church embody my values? We have to figure out a way to say, because yours are the wrong values. And we have to figure out how those values have been traduced to us. How did I receive the faith? Why am I a Baptist? Why didn't I just pick up my Bible and figure it out, take a rough go and boil up my own religion? As many people are doing with their home churches today. Why don't I do that? And folks, I don't have the answer. I just want to raise the question because this is the reality. This was the reality as of 1993. How many years removed from that are we? It's like an entire generation removed from that. And so you see, if any of you use Twitter, I don't recommend it. But if you're interested in this sort of thing, that's a really good place to observe these phenomena happening. Unfolding in real time. You've got the most doctrinally conservative dudes, and I use that word advisedly, out there, you know, with the hair, you know. Actually, they're not doing that anymore. It's a lot of it's glasses. You can identify a dude by his glasses, and stuff. But these doctrinally conservative dudes are you know, they were raised on that kind of music and that kind of a pulpit demeanor where, you know, jeans and the Mickey Mouse T-shirt, that's okay. Thanks, Mark Driscoll. They were raised with that mentality. They came up through the youth groups, and they revered guys who were doing this and pushing in this direction. And now that's the new normal. That's the new normal. How do we answer that? How do we answer when somebody moves into our town, we're the only gospel-preaching church there, and somebody says, yeah, what about the music? Yeah. German tunes, you know. Don, 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 you know. How do we answer that? How do we minister to them? My time is gone. But my desire was to open the floor for discussion, because I think that this is a discussion in the real world in which we live. You know, there's this whole other thing out there where people are being won to less and less Christianity, right? As embodied in the things that they do surrounding, if you want to use the word, their cultus, their forms, their observances. So, let me fast forward here and get to my prepared questions. So, how do we teach our own flocks, for one thing, to value the past, to value the future? Is that something that we can do? And I'm soliciting, you know, new pastor here, don't have the answer. David. Ask your wife, I bet she'd know. Ask your wife, I bet she'd know. No, not so much? Perfect. You're in. Yeah. Well, I think that your answer gives at least a philosophical foundation that we could build something on. You know, more structure would need to be added to that. Sure, for sure. But good. Anybody else have any remarks on that? How do you teach? Yes, Jason. Thank you. So let's dial that back from specific example more to even more general than that. But looking at people in the church or people not as as commodities, maybe, and more as actual image bearers, you know, how fancy can we get there? But actually trying to love them rather than, you know, boost attendance or whatever that, if that's not a corrupting alloy maybe in our motivation for reaching out to somebody, you may or may not end up as a member of my church, but that's not going to change the nature of the grace that I'm going to extend to you, because you might end up in the OPC church or you might end up here or there. If you're completely wrong about baptism, that may be where you end up. You know, and whether we can call you a Christian or not is subject to debate too. But I think you bring up a really, really good point there. Starting with just being Christian towards somebody. And you know, let's just theorize for a second. What if we're right? Should that change the way that our Christianity is lived out? What if we're right about all this arcane stuff that we're teaching? I think it should have a deepening effect. I think it should have a softening effect on the way that we interact with people. You know, it should have a way of making our concern. I mean, for the young people, the people who are going to have to take up this torch and go after we croak, okay? Because that's going to happen. And nobody's in a hurry to do that. Okay, excellent. Thank you. Anybody else on how do we teach our flocks? Yes, sir. Consistency. Yeah.
There's such consistency here that you know, it propels them to want to be diaconic.
Yeah.
They care so much because they see the truth of what it's about.
Hmm. Yeah. Yes, sir, Jason. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Well, that's a scenic overlook that I'm going to have to explore, because the idea of honor, that's helpful. I do want to just plant in your mind one other question. Where on the spectrum, we can finish this in 2 minutes, no problem. Where on the spectrum should we orient ourselves between synchronic and diachronic? You know, how much emphasis does this need to take? You know, fellowship obviously is important. Outreach is important. Personal life with Christ is important. And we recognize, or at least the Scripture demonstrates that the past is important. I think it also demonstrates that the future is important. But I think that this is something that we really do need to be careful with. You know, and I'll open it up for discussion. I mean, I'm not looking for a 1 to 10 synchronic, diachronic. I think that would be not useful. But I throw it out there for discussion. Yes, sir.
If
Oh boy.
Which is synchronic studies done over diachronic levels. So, put it in this context. It's not just enough to look at what people before us did.
Yeah.
But how did they event like? What was their life with Christ like?
Right.
And so I think there's something instructive there that by looking at the whole scope of the history that's gone before us, and not simply a narrow line of it, we can then hopefully insert ourselves within that tradition.
Yeah. Yeah. Did everybody hear that? Let me summarize it this way. Augustine, whom I referred to at the beginning, using the proper pronunciation, he actually lived a life. And you can read about it in his confessions, right? He embodied his values in a certain way. Is that kind of what you're referring to? So looking at Augustine, not just Augustine taught this proposition, but look at Augustine's life. Here's how he fleshed it out. I'm not a big reader of biographies. I'm slowly learning that I need to become one. And that's a deficiency in my own. But thank you. That's actually helpful. Time-wise, it's 1:30 now. I'm usually famous for going over. I haven't today. And so I do thank you. I thank you for the opportunity to present this. And I invite comment, criticism, everything. Because this is not my field of expertise. This is my field of interest, and there's a huge difference. Jason.